Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Fresh Frozen Southerner podcast. My name is Jay. I hope all is well. And ladies and gentlemen, today is the day after many, many, many delays and a couple of months putting it off. Today is the day we are going to dive into Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Now, it's been long enough that people probably don't remember that that's what I was going to be talking about, and probably a lot of people don't care at this point. But we are going to dive right in. I want to share two quick takeaways with you that I've gotten out of this pamphlet just right off the bat. The first thing is, if you've ever read anything that was written by the founders, it's difficult to understand exactly what it is they're saying, because they speak in such, or they write in such flowery language, and the sentence structure is different. And a lot of times when I'm reading something written by George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, I find myself going back and rereading sentences two or three times to try to puzzle out exactly what he's trying to say. And that's just because the language changed, verbiage changed, you know, sentence structure changes. A lot of times I'm reading this stuff and I'm looking at it and I'm trying to think, why would he put a comma there? Shouldn't that be one thought? Why did he pause in the middle of that statement? And then the way they'll use words is completely different a lot of times than what we do. Thomas Paine's writing is a little more simplistic. Now, I think that this is possibly because he believed that the intellectual elites, the educated people in the country, had already chosen a side. They were either loyalists or they were for independence. And I think that he was writing this for the more common person, you just the schmoes living in the country on a farm. I don't think that he was, you know, intentionally talking down to people, but I think that he might have pared his writing back a little bit to try to make it more clear. Also, you got to understand, a lot of these people, they couldn't read, so they were going to taverns and going to church meetings, and this was being read to them. And if you cut out a lot of that big words that those people never use, it probably would be a little more easy for them to understand. Now, that's just my hypothesis. I did not do any research into that. Maybe that's just how he wrote. Yeah, but it's a little more straightforward than a lot of the stuff you read from that period from people that had been educated in America in colleges. It's almost like they're trying to... Sorry about that. It's almost like they're trying to show off how educated they are. And I guess if you spend that time going to college, it's not a bad thing to show it off. But it does make it a little difficult to read. And Thomas Paine's writing is a little more straightforward. I'm going to read to you the foreword from the book so you get an idea of what the writing sounds like. I'm not going to read this book word for word. That would probably be a copyright infringement, and I just don't want to do that. I want to tell you what I think about it as we go along, not just read it verbatim. But this is the introduction to Thomas Paine's Common Sense. Perhaps the sentiments contained in the following pages are not yet sufficiently fashionable to procure them from general favor. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it the superficial appearance of being right, and rises at first to a formidable outcry in defiance of custom. But the tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason, as a long and violent abuse of power is generally the means of calling it the right of it in question, and in matters too which might never have been thought of, had not the sufferers been aggravated into inquiry. And as the King of England hath undertaken in his own right to support the Parliament in what he calls theirs, and as the good people of this country are grievously oppressed by the combination, they have undoubted privilege to inquire into the pretensions of both, and equally to reject the usurpations of either. In the following sheets, the author has studiously avoided everything which is personal among ourselves. Compliments as well as censure to individuals make no part thereof. The wise and the worthy need not the triumph of a pamphlet, and those whose sentiments are injudicious or unfriendly will cease of themselves unless too much pains are bestowed upon their conversion. The cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. Many circumstances have and will arise which are not local, but universal, and through the principles of all lovers of mankind are affected, and in the event of which their affectations are interested. The laying of a country desolate with fire and sword, declaring war against the natural rights of all mankind, and extirpating the defenders thereof from the face of the earth, is the concern of every man to whom nature hath given the power of feeling, of which class, regardless of party censure, is. And then there is a short postscript to this. It was written after the book was published, I believe. But he's talking about why he submitted this anonymously. It was just signed an Englishman. But he goes on to say, who the author of this production is wholly unnecessary to the public, as the object for attention is the doctrine itself, not the man. Yet it may not be unnecessary to say that he is unconnected with any party and under no sort of influence, public or private, but the influence of reason and principle. Philadelphia, February 14, 1776. I like the thought behind that sentiment. I like that he wanted people to pay attention to his words and not who was doing the writing. Although, it seems to me that by putting that in and submitting it anonymously, you're kind of letting people know that this is somebody of note that's writing this. Because if this was just Charles Watson from some little town outside of Reading, Pennsylvania, it wouldn't matter if he put his name on it because nobody knows who the hell he is anyway. So it was kind of tipping his cap that it was somebody that they had probably read, probably somebody in the public that was writing this. The second takeaway I have from Common Sense is that there's no fiery rhetoric in this writing. It's all spoken with just the calm assurance of someone that knows what they're saying is just the simple truth. And I feel like that is more powerful than a bunch of flamboyant language and rallies to action. It's kind of like what we have now. I mean, you can read the simplest story in the newspaper and they will do everything to make the headlines grab you. And I understand they're trying to get readers, but a lot of times once you read the story, you're like, well, then, God, this guy's full of crap. What was that headline supposed to be? There's none of that in here. It's just he's very calm. He's very measured in what he's saying. And I really think that in the long run, that will have a greater effect on people than you shouting at them and trying to get them all pumped up and ready to go. But enough foreplay. Let's jump right into this. And let me read you the opening chapter. And again, I promise I'm not going to read this verbatim, but a lot of good thoughts in here. And that's something else I'm noticing about this book. It is jam-packed with good thoughts. He does not waste a lot of time getting to his point in this stuff. Some writers have so confounded society with government as to leave little or no distinction between them, whereas they are not only different, but have different origins. Society is produced by our wants, and government by our wickedness. The former promotes our happiness positively by uniting our intentions, the latter negatively by restraining our vices. The one encourages intercourse, the other creates distinctions. The first is a patron, the last a punisher. And what he's saying when he's talking about this is that humans will form a society to fill needs within the community. You know, if you have one person living out in the wilderness, it's very, very difficult for that individual to survive and make a life all by himself. If you have several settlers out in that area, you know, they will start to help each other. They'll build their farms close enough to each other to where, you know, when you need to raise a barn, your neighbors can come over and help, and vice versa. You can go help them if a cow is sick or if they need to redo the roof on their cabin. That is forming a society where the people help each other based on what they can do for each other and what those individuals need. And that is what he means when he says that society affects us positively. And of course, his use of the word intercourse is not what we think of when we hear intercourse. In this time and in this usage, it simply means interactions between people. Although the fact that we didn't go extinct proves that there was some of the other intercourse happening. But the formation of government always comes because the need for regulation means that things are getting a little out of hand. And of course, I don't mean there's just, you know, somebody going on a killing and raping spree, but it just means that there needs to be some rules to help people stay in line. I've heard people theorize that religion sprang from the exact same thing. You had these very uncivilized people that you were trying to force some civilized behavior onto. And in a lot of cases, the threats of some heavenly punishment was one of the only things that could keep people from just running out and doing whatever the hell they wanted to do. But government comes from our inability to do the right thing all the time. Thomas Paine says that if we could form a utopia, there would be no need for government, simply because nobody would ever do anything that needed any official correction. In fact, in the book, he says, "The palaces of kings are built on the ruins of the bowers of paradise." But even though Thomas Paine understood that human frailties necessitate the formation of a government at some point, he also understood that it had an insidious way of just growing. Going back to the example of settlers moving into a new part of the world, the necessity, like a gravitating power, would soon form our newly arrived immigrants into society, the reciprocal blessings of which would supersede and render the obligations of law and government unnecessary while they remained perfectly just to each other. But as nothing but heaven is impregnable device, it will unavoidably happen that in proportion as they surmount the first difficulties of immigration, which bound them together in a common cause, they will begin to relax in their duty and attachment to each other, and this remissness will point out the necessity of establishing some form of government to supply the defect of moral virtue. Now he goes on to say, the government will take more and more power, and as the population grows, it'll become more and more restrictive to the people moving into that area and the people that were already there. Prudence will point out the propriety of having elections often, because of the elected might by the means return and mix again with the general body of the electors in a few months. Their fidelity to the public will be secured by the prudent reflection of not making a rod for themselves. And this is something that the founders really meant for our government to be. The people were supposed to go into the government, serve one term, maybe two, and then go back to their lives. It was not supposed to be a career. And that's the problem that we're having in our society right now, the elected officials in our society, is these people get elected to Congress and they'll stay there for 30 years. And I have no doubt that a lot of people, probably more the House of Representatives than the Senate, because it seems like the senators are all career politicians when they're elected. But a lot of people do get elected to the House of Representatives just out of private society. And I have no doubt that a lot of those people are good. They have good intentions. But once you've been there for a few years, I think they fall in love with the pomp and the circumstance and going to the black tie affairs and just getting catered to everywhere they go. You know, the old saying, you know, power corrupts. I think these people start out with good intentions, although I would argue that you've already got something wrong with you if you want to run for federal office. Just the garbage that these people go through during the election process, you have to have something wrong with you to want to put yourself through that. And not only do they grow apart from the American populace when they're doing this, it also insulates them from what they're doing to the people. He says, you know, they would not make a rod for themselves because they're going to be back in that pool of people very shortly. Well, when you're going to be in Congress until you can retire, you don't have to worry about any of this stuff. There is a famous quote by somebody, and I'm sorry the name escapes me, but this gentleman served several terms in Congress. And then I don't know if he retired or if he got voted out of office, but when he got back as just a private citizen, he wanted to open a bed and breakfast or a hotel. After trying to worm his way through all the regulations that it takes to open a business, he was quoted as saying that if he knew how hard he was making it on the small business owner to actually start up and operate a business, he would not have voted for most of the regulation that he did vote for in his time in Congress. Which brings up another interesting point in that if the people in Congress don't know what they're voting for, then the people in the populace don't know who to blame for whatever's going wrong in their lives. There's always somebody they can point a finger at and say, well, you know, I didn't do it. This guy or this girl over here did it, which causes a lot of problems because if there's always somebody else you can blame, public sentiment never gets galvanized against anybody for actually doing something. Now, Thomas Paine grew up in England, and he used the English parliamentary system as an example of this. You know, it's very close to our system, actually. You know, we have the president and we have Congress, and then there's the judicial system that are supposed to be checks for each other. Well, in the English parliamentary system, they also have sort of three branches, which is the monarchy, which is the king, or at this moment, the queen, and then the two houses of parliament, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. Now, the House of Lords is exactly what it sounds like. The royalty, the lords and the dukes and the ladies, they are members of the House of Lords. And the House of Commons is people elected from the populace. Now, in theory, These three houses are supposed to check each other. The monarchy, the House of Lords, and the House of Commons are all supposed to have equal weight and sort of be checks against each other. Thomas Paine says that the problem with this is that while in theory the House of Lords are supposed to be a check against the monarchy, it's made up of people that own their wealth and their lands and their titles to the monarchy. So they are almost always going to weigh in on the side of the monarchy, which makes the House of Commons basically powerless. And he's talking about, why would you give somebody power that needed to be checked in the first place? And he writes, "How came the king by a power which the people are afraid to trust and always obliged to check? Such a power could not be the gift of wise people. Neither can any power which needs checking be from God, yet the provision which the Constitution makes supposes such a power to exist. But the provision is unequal to the task. The means either cannot nor will not accomplish the end, and the whole affair is a fellow de se." A fellow de se is Latin for felony against oneself. Basically, it's something you did to yourself that you didn't need to. "For as the greater weight will always carry up the less, and as all the wheels of a machine are put into motion by one, it only remains to know which power in the Constitution has the most weight, for that will govern. And though the others, or a part of them, may clog, or as the phrase is, check the rapidity of its motion, yet so long as they cannot stop it, their endeavors will be ineffectual. The first moving power will at last have its way, and what it wants in speed is supplied by time." Basically, he's saying that no matter the intentions, no matter the system set up to prevent it, the power will concentrate. And it, I swear, it's like he could be talking about our government today instead of the monarchy in England 200 years ago. That's just how societies evolve. People that hate the founders don't truly hate the founders. They hate this country. And so they have to hate the founders because they have to discount this thing that they created. It's less about the men and more about they just have an issue with America. And again, that used to be fringe thinking. It was the town crazy person standing on the street corner yelling this stuff at people as they drove past. But suddenly it's become part of the progressive mindset. And when you hate something, you're going to hate every part of it, no matter whether it's good or bad. And like I say, that used to be kind of out on the fringe thinking, but you know, this is a consequence of putting the most extreme people in charge of our society. All right, guys, that brings us to the end of the first section. Even though this is just a pamphlet and not a full-blown book, it is divided into chapters. So I think that's a good place to stop for this episode. Plus, I'm having some issues with my throat. It's really scratchy, and I'm having a hard time talking at this point. So we are going to wrap things up here. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you enjoyed hearing a little bit about common sense. I don't think there are a lot of people in our society that have read this at this point in our history. If you did enjoy the show, please leave me a like and a subscription. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, so leave me a comment. You can leave a comment at freshfrozensoutherner@gmail.com or at the Fresh Frozen Southerner Facebook page. All right, guys, I hope everybody's enjoying their summer. I'm sorry I've spoken to you so rarely. We're going to get back on track, though. I hope you had a good day. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we will talk again very soon. Thank you very much.